produced by Jeffrey Grisellius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, VR Hoisington, and Wayne Hall. This is Yes Music Podcast episode 373, revisiting Yes's first album.
This is Bill Bruford, the ever-enthusiastic young drummer from the group Yes, and you're listening to the Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 373 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine, and co-host Mark Anthony Kay will be along a little bit later on. You can always get involved with the podcast, and please do, via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. This week, Mark and I have been listening to the first Yes album, to link in with it being released on coloured vinyl for this year's Record Store Day, 50 years after first appearing. We also consider what we would release for Record Store Day if it was up to us. More on that later. Also this week, in the Patreon group, we've given away another two books. This time it's Martin Popoff's Time is a Word, The Yes Story. We will also be having a draw for two copies of Key Studio, and you still have time to sign up and take part in that if you'd like to support the podcast financially. Just go to patreon.com, patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast for all the details. On Facebook this week, Mark shared photos of one of his copies of that first Yes album, and Preston Frazier shared his latest review. This time, it's the title song from Open Your Eyes, which gets a favourable write-up from Preston. This week saw the long-anticipated beginning of John Anderson's Thousand Hands solo tour, with several short sets at Disney's Epcot. Billed as warm-up dates, the videos show a decent band and Anderson on very fine form. Some of the arrangements are a little questionable, perhaps, but I think they will be very enjoyable concerts indeed. The new music comes over quite well, I think, but we'll need to see what it's all like in person. Hopefully those of us on this side of the pond will get a chance to find out. More rumours floated around about Anderson and Howe teaming up in the future, but without a lot of basis as far as I can see, and Daniel Crone was back with his comments on Open Your Eyes. Dave Fagan shared the Chris Squire commentary on Fish Out of Water and the John Kirkman interview, both of which were part of the DVD package a few years ago, I think. In the visitor posts, Tim Stannard shared the Billy Sherwood interview on progrockpodcast.com from last year, and Brian Sullivan posted Josh Silverstein's link to All Fighters Past, the unused track from the Fragile Sessions which eventually turned up on The Revealing Science of God. It's one of the best so-called lost songs I've heard, and Rick Wakeman even slots in the riff from Siberian Katru, as well as a stunning Hammond solo. Over on Twitter, Billy Sherwood has a new account. You can find him at BillySherwood5, and he's also got his media team to create a new Instagram home for him, which is under the name at BillySherwoodMusic. Maybe he's lost his logins to the regional accounts. Who knows? I don't know anything about it, and I'm not sure I want to, but John Wetton's estate are suing Eddie Jobson. I'll leave you to find out more. Brian Neeson continued to promote the Prog in the Park Festival, as well as establishing a new Facebook group for those Yes fans in the UK who would like to have an event in between visits of the actual band. Ken Fuller sent through a link to the Alan White interview where he talks about releasing the Led Zeppelin and Yes project XYZ. I'll believe that when I see it, as well as a new Yes album. And thank you to all the people who posted thoughts on John Anderson's Open on last week's show notes, including Tony Handley, Brian Breen, John Parry and Ian NB. And many thanks indeed to everyone who's been in touch in any way this week.
Hello, this is Roger Dean and you're listening to the Yes Music Podcast. Allegedly.
Fairly obviously, the Yes album, which is being reissued on coloured vinyl for Record Store Day 2019 on its 50th birthday, was the first one I ever talked about on the Yes Music Podcast. So that was back in episode 1 on the 21st of September 2011. As I write this, that's 390 weeks ago, or 89 months. You may have been listening for a lot of that time, or you may be rather newer to the show. Whatever, thank you very much indeed for listening. Anyway, what did I say right back then about Yes's first album? Well, I thought it had fewer of these things. Yes, mysticism, apart from the lyrics perhaps, long song forms, quasi-orchestral arrangements, but it is still a great album, works as a collection of varied songs, some beautiful, some powerful melodies, and exciting and complex arrangements, combined with subtle and virtuosic musicianship. So it's an album I've always loved. I picked up my first copy of it on vinyl around 1984 or 85. It's an 80s repressing, but I've always appreciated the fact that it still contains, I think, all the basic features of the original UK version. Let me know if I'm completely wrong about that. It sports the black cover with the Peter Banks Yes speech bubble logo, identical on front and back, and the Atlantic logo is misprinted on my copy. Perhaps that makes it a priceless article. I'd rather think not. A gatefold sleeve reveals a wonderful purple-tinged monochrome photo of the band. Squire, Bruford and Anderson are practically unrecognisable because of very unusual haircuts, and it feels very Flower Power influenced. But it was 1969, so that's hardly a surprise. There are also inset individual photographs of the five musicians playing at what looks like an outdoor gig under a striped canopy of some kind. In these ones, everyone looks more identifiable, apart from Squire. On the left-hand side of the gatefold, there is a passage of text from Melody Maker journalist Tony Wilson, which is worth reading out in full. He says, "At the beginning of 1969, I was asked, as were all Melody Maker writers, to pick two groups who I thought would make it in the following year. One of my choices was Led Zeppelin, a bit obvious perhaps, but then we all like to back a winner occasionally. The other was Yes. I'd just heard them in a London discotheque, where all too often the groups tend to be over-amplified and under-talented. Yes were not. They had much more than the usual wallpaper music sound. There was life, vitality and musicianship in their approach. They had a superior vocal sound, assured, clear and harmonic. They knew what they were doing and did it with style. It showed in their own songs and imaginative arrangements. It all shows on this, their first album. So Yes became my other choice, my second runner in the great group most likely to make it stakes, and my money is on them. Naturally, I've watched them with special interest, at the Marquee, the Speakeasy, in concert with Janis Joplin and Cream. Totally convinced after these events, my choice is confirmed." The other inclusion I love is the lyrics sheet, which, like my copy of Time is a Word, is printed on a 12-inch card. An amusing twist is that it's printed in diamond format and includes that brilliant logo, Yes, again. So, even before putting the needle to the record, as I did many times in the 1980s, I enjoyed the presentation of the album very much. Now, 50 years after the record was released, I'm going to listen again and see what I think of the album in its entirety. The opener, Beyond and Before, is a slightly odd mix. Banks and then other instrumentalists start in something like the kind of style you would expect from the live shows around this time, or at least the second-hand view I have of them. It's committed, loud, emphatic stuff, but then the vocal harmonies catapult us back into the 60s flower power psychedelic era. They are very well arranged and brilliantly performed, but they sound a bit incongruous, and despite the great Squire descending figure and fabulous Bruford drumming, the vocals are just a little bit limp in comparison to the instrumental parts. It's possibly down to production, but maybe it's to do with the inevitable compromises the band thought they had to make in a recorded offering which appeared in 1969. I really like the song, but a different vocal approach would have helped it really to blast out of the speakers and feel like a full-throttle opening number. Tony Kaye's keyboards are also practically absent from most of the song. The ending works much better and perhaps even hints at some of the approach to come, with a quiet, contrasting close, which is then blasted out of the way in a precursor of prog epilogues of years later. The vocals are highly effective here, but the same approach doesn't seem to work as well in the former part of the song for me. I See You features some jazzy drumming, bluesy guitar soloing and great Squire patterns from the first second. That harmony vocal approach is back again, but in this context it's far more appropriate. Psychedelia is woven in effectively this time, and the instrumental arrangement doesn't battle against it. The band made no secret that they were trying to create melodic, vocally intricate music at this point, and I See You accomplishes this with some significant success. The instruments do get more powerful and insistent, but the structure works well with some lovely Banks and Bruford moments, and you can see why Steve Howe maintains that Banks was the originator of the Yes guitar sound. Yes also pushed the boundaries of genre here, with the blending of jazz, blues and psychedelic pop. You don't find many explorative solo electric guitar and drum passages in the middle of pop songs of any era. What follows is also a superb demonstration of Banks's versatility and control of rock soloing, and the Yes arrangement in cover versions is showcased here. I think this is a remarkable achievement which does bring some of the wild abandon of those earliest concerts into the studio. Anderson leads from the front with some powerful singing, and it's a deeply satisfying song. Tony Kaye is a little bit more present, but hasn't had any moments in the spotlight as yet. Yesterday and Today is a tiny and beautiful palate cleanser after the dramatic ending of the previous song. I really like the Kaye piano work here, particularly his beautiful solo passage which phases across the beat in a deceptively simple way. Strummed acoustic guitar makes a pleasant texture, along with deft and highly appropriate bass touches, and we can see the band have tried out a few different techniques as soft Banks electric guitar floats across the scene. I know some fans find this song a bit limp, but if you listen closely to what's happening in the arrangement, it is a fascinating mix. Incidentally, have you ever noticed how often the theme of time comes up in the first two albums? It's probably coincidence, but on Yes, we have Beyond and Before, Yesterday and Today, and Survival, which includes the line, "Yesterday's endings will tomorrow life give you." Then on Time and a Word, there's the title song, then Every Day's and The Prophet, which ends, "Just remember when you're gone, there's someone after you." You'll be able to choose plenty of other examples of this thematic repetition from the wider catalogue as well. Anyway, back to the first album and the song Looking Around. Here we do have Kay's first big appearance with some brilliant Hammond organ playing. The vocal harmonies are properly integrated again into the song, which has moments of hiatus in the tempo to keep the audience interested, despite a rollicking motion underpinned by Bruford and Squire's immense rhythm section. Banks gets his solo moment, as does Squire, and there's great spirit to the song alongside a catchy melodic vocal treatment. It's full of energy and the 4 minutes and 2 seconds speed past in a blur of youthful excitement, but which also integrates some great contrasts. Harold Land also blasts off with a wonderful Squire bassline and some more fine Hammond sounds. It's rather more laid back than the previous song, but it retains some great energy. It's an unusual sounding song again with remarkable contrasts. The verse is supported by both Hammond and piano, which produces a lovely effect. The lyrics are intriguing in a Beatles-esque manner, dealing with war and its effects on those involved, another recurring theme for the band. Again, this song is very memorable with some really great instrumental and vocal arrangement. The lyrics are rather more descriptive and understandable than Anderson's later approach, but the song has a satisfying shape and is very enjoyable, with the opening figures reappearing at the end and Kay given ample opportunity to shine. The Beatles' cover, Every Little Thing, is a remarkably good attempt at capturing the live band's amazing reinterpretations of other people's songs. The opening features all the instrumentalists on fire and working through the material in a highly dramatic manner. Out of this maelstrom suddenly emerges the first really recognisable riff of the original song, and we have the first proper order out of chaos moment, which is to become one of the trademarks of the band in future times. Not everyone likes the Peter Banks day tripper quotation popping up here, but I do. Anderson's vocals are strong and precise against the band's accompaniment to the Beatles version, and the vocal harmonies in the chorus are superb. There are a couple of odd notes in there which may have been accidental, but it's all highly enjoyable, and I do think it works a lot better than the Beatles' original. Banks and Squire collaborate on some fantastic passages, and Bruford is driving the drum kit with what appears to be wild abandon, but, perhaps in contradiction, always perfectly in control. The music ebbs and flows in a very creative manner, and you can clearly hear the amount of time and attention that's been paid to the arrangement. It's a great version, and the playout completes it in fine style. Sweetness is rather different. A soft, intimate Hammond organ part is joined by an astonishingly mobile bass line, strummed electric guitar, percussion and layered vocals. Anderson's main vocal line takes over in a tender fashion, and the backing vocals are particularly good once again. I really like the Banks wah pedal-soaked accompaniment against Anderson and Squire. Once again, it's a catchy piece which builds from the opening piece to a rather stronger section before ebbing again. A simple song on the surface, I think the arrangement again shows us the skill of the musicians to construct something effective from some quite basic ingredients. It also shows us that the band have a range of modes and approaches. They weren't just a bash and crash explosive live band. There was a lot of subtlety as well in the early concoction. The final song, Survival, begins with one of the most amazing Chris Squire moments of the whole Yes canon. He solos in a way nobody else can, with a twisting, oscillating sound to introduce the band. Banks employs his volume pedal to great effect, again, foreshadowing Howe techniques. The longest song on the album, Survival, has an extensive introduction which lasts over a minute before a completely different feel is faded in as the former is faded out. Banks strums peacefully on his electric guitar, accompanying his own acoustic soloing, and Hammond tones flit about attractively. "Sunshine is creeping in," sings Anderson, as his vocal line does indeed do the same. Bruford might have found us all too cloying and drippy, but I rather like it. The vocal line has a lovely shape as it climbs and returns towards the bridge and chorus, which has one of the best hooks in Yes music. It has a compulsive sing-along character which never gets too insistent, but carries the listener along on the earliest example of a Yes wave of positivity. The build-up to the bridge and chorus is a sumptuous treat, and is as effective as many of the classic anthems from other bands, which you can, I'm sure, quote. Hammond organ, drums and bass work in complementary fashion with those layered vocals. The only part which is almost completely absent is Banks' guitar, perhaps signalling that the direction the band wanted to go in didn't easily align with his preferred style. I think Survival makes a brilliant end to this album, which feels like a young band trying different things out in the studio, which is no surprise at all. I like all the songs, but I think if I had to choose the piece which points us forwards to the coming success of the band, it would have to be Harold Land, combined with Survival, at risk of cheating. I think the approach to structure and style in these two songs are what was developed by the band into its progressive heyday, although there's plenty of development in the intervening time, not least facilitated by the critical changes of personnel which are to come. The cover version arrangements, like Every Little Thing, are an essential part of the Yes story, but really didn't survive beyond these earliest years, despite being some of my favourite Yes music, and wonderful to hear live throughout the decades.
Greetings, friends. So this week, Kevin and I are going to be talking about the very first Yes album, simply titled Yes. I believe that the reason for our discussing this album this week is because earlier on, the people in charge of Record Store Day released their list of albums for this April, and the debut Yes album was one of the albums listed on there, coming out as a colored vinyl release. So I think this got us all excited about this album again, and we decided to talk about it. Not so much, at least from my end, in great detail about the songs, but more what the album means to me overall. So just some quick information for those of you who might not be too familiar with the record. The first Yes album came out on July 25th, 1969. It was released on Atlantic Records and was produced by Paul Klee. There was, in fact, two singles released from this album. One was Sweetness, backed with Something's Coming, which is a non-album song. That was released on July 4th of 1969, 2 weeks or so before the album came out. And the second single was Looking Around, backed by Every Days, which was released on November 3rd, 1969. A couple of things that are interesting about this record. It's one of the albums from the Yes catalog that has an alternate album cover. The UK version that came out simply had a black background with Yes within sort of like a bubble text situation. And the second album cover, the alternate, was used in the United States and in other countries like Canada as well, which was simply a picture of the band standing in front of a building. So first off, I'd just like to say that this is one of the albums that I got into kind of late as far as my listening to Yes music is concerned. I got into Yes, as you all know, from listening to 90125 when I was much younger and sort of worked my way backwards through their catalog. This album and Time and a Word, I got to really near the end of my discovery of Yes, and I found it quite interesting and almost kind of surprising that the band that they were at the beginning was much more of a rock band situation than the progressive band that we come to love. Much more straightforward, more simplistic, not as many long songs in there. But definitely one thing that I've grown to love about this record in particular is the sort of youthful fire that comes with releasing a debut record. I think that's one thing that hasn't changed with bands over the years, is that once you have a situation in which you can go in and record your very first record, that sort of excitement and energy always seems to appear on the album. Whether it's your best work or not is irrelevant. I just think that sort of energy always seems to be present on debut records. And this one obviously has that in great amounts. Songs that come to mind right away where I find that that's very evident is Looking Around, for example. Beyond and Before is definitely a great beginning or great opener. You can literally hear Chris Squire's excitement of recording just from those opening notes that he does on the bass guitar. I also think that Every Little Thing, that the cover that they did, the Beatles cover, turned out fantastic and is one that shows their sort of experimentation that they would get into much more deeply as they wrote more and more music. If I was to pick a favorite song off of this album, I would have to say I think it's Looking Around. I think it's mainly because I've grown to love the vocals on this song very much. I think John Anderson did a great job with this song, singing-wise, which he did with almost everything that he's done on record, I have to say. He's a fantastic singer. And I also think that the music overall has a lot of that energy that I was talking about earlier, that very youthful fire going on there. But coming in a close second, I think would have to be Survival. I have always thought that that was a great song and a really great closing number on an album. I think that it's a great example of what each member of the band brought. The bass playing is great. The drumming is fantastic. Bill Bruford has a really nice jazzy touch on this. Peter Banks' guitar playing is fantastic. He does, again, trademark Peter Banks things that he normally does as far as the volume swell with the volume pedals and stuff like that. And his guitar tone is very strong on this album overall, I think. Now, if I was to rank where this album sits within the Yes catalog, even as far as a year ago, I would maybe say that it was about in the halfway point of their catalog as far as how much I love this album. But I have to admit, after doing numerous bits of research for this, whether it was for the singles episodes that we did, or whether it was just for the sake of going through records that I was interested in at the moment, this album has really went up quite a bit in ranking for me. I would have to say that it's now probably at the number 10 spot, just getting into the top 10 for me. It's that strong for me, I believe. And again, there's a lot of reasons for that. But again, I think it all stems around the fact that there's a lot of fire and a lot of great just excitement in this record. And this is something that most bands tend to lose as they go on through their careers. And Yes is one of those bands as well, that they're no different than most other bands. But the one advantage I think that Yes had over other bands, and whether you look at this as an advantage or not, I guess is up to you, but every time Yes changed out a member, I found that they recaptured a bit of that energy. Like when Steve Howe came in, they seemed to, you know, get excited again about the situation. And at that point, they really needed to put out a great album to stay on their record label. So the Yes album has that fire again. And then, of course, when Rick Wakeman joined an album after that for Fragile, I mean, the energy on that is just unbelievable. And I guess from there on, they sort of rode this wave. And then, you know, just like most bands, they started getting success and they started getting comfortable, and maybe some of that fire left them. But, you know, that's not to say that their records afterwards weren't brilliant, which we all know they were. Now, one of the questions that me and Kevin, I wanted to, I guess, ask ourselves and answer is, which song on the first album shows us most about what the band were to do later? Now, I think that for me, there are two songs that do that. But if I'm going to pick one, I'll pick Survival. I think that it has a lot of their experimentation that they would do later in there. Some of that great bass guitar playing. The drumming is really good in there. The singing is fantastic. And again, because it's a longer song, this is something that Yes would continue to dabble in with their writing as the years went on. Longer and longer pieces with more different parts within it. And this song is probably one of the great starting points of that. And I think if I was to pick an alternate or a runner-up for this question, I would have to say it was Every Little Thing. And the reason why it would be an alternate is because it's not their own song, but because they take this song and make it so much their own and kind of rework it so much, that's the reason why I would put it as a runner-up. Because if you look at how they write songs from this point on, they do this quite often where they make these kind of adjustments and they make all kinds of new pieces into it, especially with the covers that they do after this, like on the next album. They do that quite a bit. But that sort of experimentation seeps into their own original music. And I think for me, it all kind of starts at Survival. So I have very fond memories of this record, as you can tell. I only have 3 different pressings of this album on vinyl. Yeah, well, I mean, I'm sure you won't be surprised when I tell you that I know people who have upwards of maybe 10 or 11 different variations of this record, so 3 doesn't seem like a very lot for me. But I do have a nice UK reissue of it, a 1972 one. I do have a US first pressing, a 1969, which sounds very nice. And my Canadian pressing, ironically, is probably the worst sounding one. And I believe that's a 1979 or 80 possibly pressing. But in any case, I love the album no matter what the pressing is. And I enjoy listening to it very much. And those are my thoughts on this record. I'm curious to hear what Kevin thinks of this album.
So we've really enjoyed listening to the first Yes album today. And Mark's here with me now. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. How are you doing?
Not too bad, thank you. So yeah, I was very interested in your comments. A more straightforward approach, perhaps. It's not simplistic, though, and not necessarily what we see on the videos from the time, because I think those are more, and we watched some recently, didn't we, where Peter Banks was going a bit crazy, and that doesn't come across on the album. But I do think that quite a bit of that live spirit does seem to translate through into the studio recordings there, which I think is quite remarkable.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, like I mentioned before, and I'm taking this kind of from my own experience, that when you get that, when you get told that you can go in and record your first record in a recording studio, the sort of excitement that the band has at that moment is so, you can like feel it in the air. So I can only imagine that a band like Yes, who were probably hoping to do something like that, when they were told that they can go in and make a record, you know, it was probably very evident when they were in their studio doing it that they were very excited about doing it. It translated over into the playing.
Yeah, sometimes that's hampered, though, isn't it, by the production techniques in a studio. I know some amateur bands that I've known through the years have really struggled in the recording studio. But then again, having said that, apart from Bill Bruford, everybody else had had experience of recording, hadn't they? They'd been in bands before this.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right, though, about the, you know, production being sometimes a hindrance in it, because if you remember in the documentary that we usually refer back to, Peter Banks refers to saying that his situation was sort of frustrating for him because they'd always say, it's too loud, turn the amp down. There's a noise coming from somewhere. It's your amplifier, turn it down. You know, there was always something where it revolved around him. And also, it's ironic that you mentioned Bill Bruford not having any real experience. He mentions in that video too that when he was recording, he had one of the headphones on his ear and he took the other one off his ear and left his ear exposed. And he never realized that he could go and tell the engineer that he needed more guitar in his headphone or more vocal. He just took it off because he was having trouble hearing certain instruments. And then he said that he remembers that when he took his headphones off, that his Peter Banks almost blew his eardrums out with the volume that he had from his amp.
Yeah, isn't that fascinating? But certainly the others have been in the studio before and were certainly used to it. So, but they ended up being quite disappointed with that first album, I think. And some of it partly was about some compromises that they felt they had to make in terms of making this a saleable album and not necessarily what they were that interested in doing. Now that didn't come across to me particularly. I did think the first song, Beyond and Before, which I think the sort of flower power vocals don't seem to match the rest of that song, so I don't think it works there particularly. But I don't see any of the others really have any dramatic sort of compromises to a commercial version of the band at this stage. Is that something you noticed?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I don't think there's really any real compromises made, I don't think. I mean, I think that everything they did there was pretty much what they anticipated doing, I think. I think the one problem with first records that most bands have, and I think this is pretty common with most bands, is that in their mind, they're envisioning this, you know, really grandiose, spectacular record. And because of, you know, their inexperience and maybe because of budgets and stuff like that, their finished product never ends up sounding in the end what they envision in their mind.
Yeah. Something they did, I think, get absolutely right, and you mentioned it as well, was those vocal harmonies, which are actually just as strong. Now, I do think that some of the instrumental arrangements are really great on this album. There's a lot more in there, and listening to it really, really carefully this time, I could hear a lot more of those arrangements than perhaps I thought were in there. I thought they were perhaps more simple than they actually are. But the vocals, and they did say that was one of their intentions for the band, was to have amazing musicianship, but also brilliant, layered and arranged vocals, which I think they did fantastically well on this. It really did come out very, very strongly. And I think there was that band, was it called Fifth Dimension, that John Anderson said he was very keen on at the time. And also, of course, he had experience of singing with others in the Warriors. But those vocal arrangements are really, really good, aren't they, on this?
Oh, yeah. I thought that it's surprising how well their vocals were already right from the very beginning. I mean, usually bands work up to those kind of level of vocals that they had already from the very first record.
Yeah, absolutely. And is Peter Banks in the Yes choir at this stage? I think he is, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. I think he's definitely in the choir. I mean, you can see in the live performances that we've seen that he's definitely involved in it on a live point. So I'm guessing that he's very much involved in the studio, because if you remember as well, he made a comment in the documentary that he always used to go up to John and like asking him about the lyrics, like what are we singing here exactly? So I'm guessing that he would be involved in the singing part in the studio as well.
Absolutely right. And those lyrics are, they're not, I mean, I suppose maybe that's one of the compromises they made. So some of the topics and the fairly straight ahead nature of the lyrics hadn't developed into what Anderson was going to throw at the rest of the band in later years. They're a bit more literal, I suppose you could say, and telling stories and so on, like Harold Land and so on. But very effective, certainly that Yes Choir, as we've just said. Now, I was interested in where you put this in the end, in your sort of ranking of the catalogue. And I didn't actually express an opinion in my piece, but I would say certainly, and similar to you, that it's definitely halfway up or just above, if I had to rank it. And I really did enjoy it this time. And I do take it down. I mean, I suppose that's one of the key sort of markers of how good you think an album is how many times you get it off the shelf and put it on and play it. And I do listen to this record quite a few times every year, compared with some other Yes records, which I might not take off the shelf for quite some time. So I did really enjoy that. And I also very much liked your comment about the energy being recaptured when new members joined the band. And I certainly think that's true in the early years. So if you think of, as you said, Wakeman and Howe joining. And of course, Howe has gone on record, as I mentioned, saying that Peter Banks in these two records did put down the foundations. He established what Yes guitars should sound like. And there's certainly touches in this, aren't there, with the use of the volume pedal and some wah and so on. But the basic techniques and the basic sound of Yes from a guitar point of view definitely set from this point onwards.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that he definitely put down the seeds that the old guitar players, well, I mean, it's only just Steve and Trevor after that, but from which the guitar players would, you know, develop from. Because like you said, I mean, the volume pedal work is there, which Steve Howe ended up doing a lot as well. The wah work is there early on from Peter, and, you know, Steve Howe did it a lot too. I mean, he did it in Yours Is No Disgrace and various other songs as well. I mean, and then just, you know, Steve Howe just took it just a step further, introducing the lap steel and various other instruments. But Peter Banks should be definitely highly credited for laying down what the guitar player in Yes would be like from that period on. Because even if you listen to songs like Astral Traveler, there's some pretty complex guitar stuff going on in there. It's not only Steve Howe that we can refer back to having complex guitar parts.
I just wonder, though, if there's a slight tendency here, because I mentioned that I thought Tony Kaye was often pretty much missing from particularly some of the earlier songs on this record in the running order, and Peter Banks pretty much mixed out of Survival, except towards the end. So maybe there's a hint or two that the rest of the band are already thinking that those two members are not an equal status, I suppose, as the others. There's plenty of vocals, obviously, as we've already said. There's you can't get away from the rhythm section. The Squire and Bruford section is just incredible on this, and really working together exceptionally well. But perhaps they thought they had the option of not putting in the foreground the guitar and the keyboards at various points. Did you notice that at all?
Well, in the first album, not so much. I mean, there is some pretty evident keyboard playing or organ playing by Tony on that, right? I think I noticed that more on the second record, where the orchestra started stomping over certain members, i.e. Tony and Peter, right? They seemed less important on that record than in the prior one. But, you know, if that did happen in the first record, sometimes that happens because the producer has a certain vision of what he envisions the music to sound like when it's completed. And maybe his vision saw, you know, keyboards lower in the mix, maybe in certain parts. So sometimes it's not always the band that has that decision.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the three songs that we chose as, you know, showing us the most about the future of the band, Survival we both chose, and Every Little Thing you chose, and Harold Land I chose. It's very interesting that two of those three, certainly not Harold Land, which I don't think has been played very, very seldom through the years, but Survival has been played a lot, and Every Little Thing comes back every so often into the repertoire, and it's fantastic when it does. But Survival, interestingly, the last song on the album, really pointing towards some aspects of Yes, like the arrangement, like the way the melody is treated, I think, and the way it all fits together. It's more complicated. It's the longest song on the album, and certainly one that they've returned to because they think it's important. And it is. I mean, yes, a little bit Every Little Thing, but really Survival, the only one that survived, I suppose you could say, from the first album through the years.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that song, every time I listen to it, it really makes me think that, you know, this is like a blueprint of what's to come with Yes. And it's interesting that they put it at the very end, because it's almost like, you know, when you finish the record, it's like the song that you expect them to continue on from, right? Mm. So it was almost wise, like they put it there just to kind of hint at, you know, what to expect on the next album. And that's not always the case with some records.
No.
Sometimes it's just a song,
yeah,
right? But I think this time they kind of, you know, put something in there. Maybe I'd like to think that they put it there with that thought in mind, that maybe they're trying to hint at something. But I mean, like you said, that song definitely has all the elements of future Yes music in there. The performance in there is just fantastic. I mean, you can narrow it down to everything. The drumming is a little bit more adventurous. Peter Banks's guitar playing definitely has all those little volume elements, and his guitar playing style is very much more forward thinking there. And, you know, Chris Squire, what can we say about him? I mean, his bass playing is just remarkable on that song.
Yeah, absolutely is. I suppose you could call it a bit of a musical cliffhanger. So we'll leave you with this and we'll be back, is the idea. And interesting to me that's the last one, and perhaps certainly the one that's had the most longevity. And the first one on the album, Beyond and Before, was the only one I really criticised from the point of view of its construction, because of the sort of incongruity between the vocals and what the instruments were doing for me. But yeah, really, really enjoyed it. It'll be fascinating to see what the Record Store Day album looks like. And hopefully it won't be the same as the forthcoming, which I found out about this week. Keith Hoisington and I were having a little chat about it. A new version of Fragile coming out, which will fascinate you, Mark, if you haven't heard about it already, which is one of those 45 RPM, but on 12-inch discs. So two 12-inch discs, Fragile, being released, and it's going to cost £129, so you can convert that into dollars if you like, but I certainly won't be getting myself a copy of that.
Wow.
Hopefully the Record Store Day one won't be quite as expensive as that. But anyway, for now, thank you very much, Mark.
I think I just lost my breath there for a second, but yeah, you're very welcome, Kevin.
This is Two Pence with Mark Anthony Kay and Kevin Mulrine.
So we're back again for Two Pence, and Mark is still with me. So we had an idea, in fact it came from Mark, to continue talking about Yes, the first record, in the context of the Record Store Day re-release of it on that coloured vinyl that we're all looking forward to at least seeing, if not actually getting a copy of ourselves. So the question, though, we're going to talk about today is, if you were in charge of the Yes catalogue, what album would you select for Record Store Day and why? So do you want to go first then, Mark? What would you choose?
Well, believe it or not, I've been thinking about this for quite a while, actually. You know, like putting myself with my, you know, executive tie on, and what would I, you know, release if I was in charge of their catalogue. But, you know, I have a kind of grandiose vision for Record Store Day with Yes.
Right.
So I, of course, this probably would never happen, but this was my dream beyond all dreams release. And it is this. I would release all five solo records from the band on Record Store Day. Elias of Sun Hilo, Beginnings, Fish Out of Water, Ramshackled, and what was Patrick Mraz's
Story
one?
Of I.
Story of I, correct, sorry. And each of them with an associated colored vinyl. So let's say Elias green, Fish Out of Water blue for the water, ramshackled white to match the cover.
Yeah.
A sort of crazy, like, you know, jungle green for eye, and maybe for beginnings, maybe like a red or something like that, or an orange that's kind of like in this font that he has. But something like that where you can have it, it's connected to Yes.
Yeah.
But it's something that's very different and something that's unexpected. And that's the kind of thing for Record Store Day that I kind of always hope for, is something different, not just a standard, you know, let's just pick this record and give it a color now and release it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like something different, and maybe, you know, add like a bonus track, or maybe put it like a CD in with it. Like they do that now, like when Virgil Howe and Steve Howe released their record together, they put a CD of it in there, but maybe put like a bonus disc of some different songs or different alternate versions of the songs from the solo records. I think that'd be incredible.
It would be very nice indeed. So would you do that as individual records rather than in a box set?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So that people can buy whatever one they want and not be hampered with like a $500, you know, purchase.
We've just been talking about the fragile one, yes. So not in that kind of a version, certainly. No, yes, I think that would be a lovely idea, and I'd be very interested indeed in that myself. Now, I have to admit that I don't actually have a proper copy of Story of I. It's the one that I haven't got round to getting yet, so that would certainly suit me. And I do believe that Story of I is being re-released this year, not for Record Store Day, but I think it is being re-released in a new sort of packaged version, so that'll be nice to have to see that and perhaps get myself a copy of that. Yeah, very good idea. Now, I have gone for something slightly off-piste as well. And that is, I've gone for the record from Anderson, Bruford, Wakeman, Howe. Now, the reason for that is that it occurred to me this week that it's 30 years. It was 89, wasn't it? 30 years since that was released. Gosh, it seems like 5 minutes to me since I picked up my CD of that and really enjoyed, you know, hearing themes and Fist of Fire and all those sorts of things. And I've recently got hold of the re-released version, which is on two CDs and also includes Vultures in the City, which was only previously available on singles and so on. And everything else is on there as well, I think. I can't see any particular other differences there. Oh, yes, no, it's got a long edit and a CD single edit and a short edit of the singles there. So basically it's got the singles and the B-sides there in one collection, which is really, really nice. So I'd like to see that released for Record Store Day. And I'm just reminding myself, I've got it right here. I do have a vinyl copy of ABWH. And some of the things that I love about it is that it's a bit off-piste, as I say. It's a little bit different from some of the records that you might think of for release at this point. But also, it's got that amazing and wonderful Roger Dean cover, which is really one of my favourites. And just holding it in my hands here, and the wonderful lettering. But that stack, the difference between... You've got a stack of rocks right next to the blue, beautiful blue architecture, which has a sort of, they look like dolphins flying off the side of it. And you've got some of those wonderful Dean animals as well, vultures. And on the back, the sort of crazy red version with canyons in the distance and so on. I think it would work really brilliantly. And to have that re-released, but including everything that's on the CD, two CD version, so perhaps on a gatefold sleeve with a wonderful artwork and then two records inside for Record Store Day, and you could play around with the colour stuff as well, would be marvellous. One thing I just wanted to ask you about colour, though, was you've been investigating colour vinyl, haven't you, for your own records, and you've learnt a couple of things about the different colours and what works and what doesn't, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, for the most part now, coloured vinyl has become... just as stable sound-wise as most black vinyl, with the exception of a few things. I mean, I've learned and not experienced this yet because I haven't done this color yet, but I've heard from quite a few people that to stay away from doing solid white colored albums, because that seems to be one that for some reason attracts a lot more static and noise to it than some of the other ones. And I did notice that because I did buy a Bowie Record Store Day album called Bowie Now, which was like a greatest hits kind of thing that they revolved around Low and Heroes at that time period. And it was for radio stations only. And that was on solid white. And it is a little more crackly and noisy than normal records, I find. And I also have a Bowie single that's a white one like that, and it's very noisy. But the other culprit too is when you start getting these splatter vinyls that have all kinds of multiple colors in it and stuff, that, you know, they're not terrible, but, you know, if you're looking for quality sound, to kind of be weary of that, because sometimes, you know, when you're adding in all these various different colors, you know, to think about how that is. Usually when they make this splatter, it comes from a bin that has multiple pellets of different colors all mixed together.
Yeah.
So usually those are like leftovers from various different bins and stuff like that, and you mix it all together, and then you kind of get like, you know, a hodgepodge of different, you know, quality of pellets, right?
Yeah.
So when you put that in there with another color, then sometimes it doesn't sound as good together. So usually what I like to do is how I do my records is I usually do them translucent and usually pick one solid color, but this time I'm doing a solid green, but I've heard nothing bad about using the color green or the pellets revolving around that color. I am staying away from white as much as I kind of do like the look of the white vinyl, but I have been told to stay away from that.
Well, that's fascinating. Well, it'd be fascinating to see what they choose for the Record Store Day version of the first Yes album that we've been talking about today. I did slightly tongue-in-cheek to suggest that to fit in with the colours of the UK version of the front cover, they should do the special colour as black, but perhaps they'll choose a different colour. You never know. All right. So anyway, let us know what you think of the first album. Is it one of your favourites? Where does it rank for you? And also what you would like to see Yes release in the future on Record Store Day. Good fun. So thank you very much indeed, Mark, for now.
You're welcome, Kevin.
Olá, sou o Miguel Falcão, de Coimbra, Portugal. Estão a ouvir o Yes Music Podcast.
So just before we go, here's the patron update for this week. Yes Music Podcast producers are Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, VR Hoisington, Bill Govier and Wayne Hall. And Yes Music Podcast patrons are Aaron Steelman, Mark James Lang, Joost Maglev, Martin Kaelberg, Bob Martellotta, Michael O'Connor, Brian Sullivan, Miguel Falcao, Chris Bandini, Neil Caffrey, Craig Estenes, Paul Hales, Dave Owen, Paul Tomei, David Hayden, Paul Wilson, Lind, Peter Herndon, David Pannell, Lobate Scarb, Dave Watkinson, Rachel Hadaway, Dem, Mark Zarkal Bags, Doug Curran, Robert Naser, Fergus Cubbage, Scott Colombo, Fred Barringer, Scott Smith, Jeff Bailey, Simon Barrow, Jeffrey Mason, Stephen Lamb, Guy de Rome, Steve Dill, Henrik Antonsen, Steve Perry, H.G. Peterson, Steve Rode, Ian M.B., Steve Scott, Jamie McQuinn, Stephen Raw, Ken Fuller, Terence Sadler, Jeremy North, Tim Stannard, Jim, Todd Dudley, John Cowan, Tony Handley, John Holden, Joseph Cottrell, John Parry, Keith Hoisington, John Thompson, and William Hayes. Also, continued thanks to Robert and David. So thank you very much indeed to all those patrons. If you'd like to join them in the exclusive activities only they have access to, and also support the podcast financially, just head over to patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast or click on the button on the website. So that's just about all the time we have this week. Thanks so much for listening once again. I do hope we'll be back next week. But in the meantime, do follow the show on Twitter, on Instagram, or on Facebook. You can also drop me a line to show@yesmusicpodcast.com. So until next week, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.